Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. Already seems like 2020 has been around for big wars and impeachment, and we're just getting started. And I realized this morning that I put out my morning newsletter, and I did not even mention the fact that the President of the United States was being impeached. Okay, that's on me, but also an indication of just the crazy news cycle that we are constantly in, that I saw one commentator say that, you know, well, yes, it was December 19th that the House voted to impeach President Trump, but that seems so 2019. No, that seems like short attention span. But of course, that's going to come back with a vengeance, and it's difficult to talk about what's going on on the international stage without putting it in the context of the fact that the President of the United States is facing an impeachment trial, an impending impeachment trial. We don't know when Nancy Pelosi will forward those articles to the Senate, but it appears to be imminent, and then we're going to have some sort of a trial. And what we don't know is, of course, is whether or not four Republicans will stand up and say, hey, you know, given the revelations that we've had over the last couple of weeks and days, we really should have more witnesses and more documents. And, of course, the big constitutional question that we're also facing, as if that's not enough, is the question of war powers, and Nancy Pelosi announcing that she's going to be introducing a House resolution very similar to one being introduced in the Senate by Tim Kaine that will reassert Congress's long-established oversight responsibilities by mandating that if no further congressional action is taken, the administration's military hostilities with regard to Iran cease within 30 days. And I have to admit that when I sat down and was thinking about today's podcast, the one thing that occurred to me is that pretty much nobody seems to understand how the War Powers Act works and the intersection between that legislation, you know, Congress's crucial role in the declaration of war, and the president's Article I power. So who better to talk about that with than our friend, Bulwark contributor Kim Whaley, who's a professor of law, legal expert for CBS News, and the author of How to Read the Constitution and Why, which is sitting on my desk and is becoming increasingly dog-eared. So thanks for joining me on the first Monday of January. This is the first Monday of the decade. So thanks for coming on today, Kim.
Happy to be here, Charlie.
Okay, so let's talk about the War Powers Act, because I'm actually one of those people who's old enough to remember, literally, back in 1973, when Congress passed the War Powers Act, which was, you know, part of a series of bills that were passed to constrain Richard Nixon's, excessive imperial use of presidential power. But let's just talk about this. Has the Supreme Court ever ruled on the War Powers Act? No president has really ever accepted the constitutionality of the War Powers Act. Am I right about that?
Yeah, there's some question as to the constitutionality, but as you indicate, the bigger issue really is enforcement. Like with anything relating to the law or the Constitution, the Congress has the power to declare war under the Constitution. There's a statute that shores up the president's power to do that. But we've seen Congress after Congress under numerous presidents essentially sit back and allow that power to sort of accumulate in the executive branch. So this is another one of the areas where the Constitution is sort of being amended before our eyes without an actual process of amendment. That is, the executive branch is getting more and more powerful under our Constitution, not by virtue of changes to the actual document, but by virtue of basically letting stuff slip and not Congress not stepping up and enforcing its own prerogative as a check on the presidency.
Okay, so Article 1 says Congress has the power to declare war. Pretty clear.
Right.
Article 2 says the president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. So this is where we get to the ambiguity. The president orders a bombing or an attack on a foreign country. Is this an act of war that requires congressional approval, or is this the president acting as commander-in-chief? How have we sorted this out?
So, right. So this is the classic chicken and egg type problem. Does the president have to await a congressional declaration of war before he uses any military force? If that theory would support the war power as being primary, or so long as Congress creates an army and navy, Can the president then use those forces as he sees fit as part of his commander-in-chief power? Most scholars believe that the framers thought the president could use power to repel attacks, but not to affirmatively initiate attacks. And this was something the framers talked about at the time that the war powers was debated at the Constitutional Convention. And there was an argument that the executive would basically, whoever's in that office, would have the character, the inherent character, not to declare wars without public support. And then other people at the convention said, wait a minute, that we can't expect to give power to an individual. Remember, the framers were worried about having no more kings in America. We can't basically give unilateral power to one person under our new constitution. So I think the weight of authority would be certainly Congress has a role here. Congress isn't just sitting back and watching what the president does when it comes to instigating attacks on somebody very high up, basically murdering someone high up within the Iranian military apparatus and governmental apparatus at an airport in plain day in Iraq. I mean, that's pretty significant, pretty substantial. And I think most scholars would say Congress at least should have known in advance. Allies should have at least known in advance. And some would say there should have been a debate on the floor of both houses, and that should have been authorized. And as you mentioned, the War Powers Resolution in 1973 actually imposes legally some additional statutory obligations on the president, which don't appear to have been authorized here. The Supreme Court's likely to come in if this were to be a question and say, listen, this is a political question. We're out of that, to answer your initial question about how the courts might weigh in on this.
So has the War Powers Act itself ever actually been invoked?
In terms of stopping an actual...
Yes.
To my knowledge, no.
Yeah.
That hasn't actually, Congress hasn't come in and said,
right,
listen, President, we are going to condemn this. And I think we're seeing now Nancy Pelosi wanting to basically put juice in that statute. And we're seeing this across the board in other parts with respect to this president. The issue really comes down to enforcement, not what the law says, but whether it's enforced. If laws aren't enforced, the law ceases to become important.
Yeah, you make the point in your book, there's no cop on the block willing to enforce Article 1 in this regard. And in order for Congress to make its power meaningful, it would have to do something like cut off funding for the military until the president, you know, complies with the Constitution, the War Powers Resolution. And as you point out, that's not going to happen.
Right. I mean, that's not realistic. Yeah. Or we could see it through an impeachment process, or we see it through voting. I mean, those are essentially the ways that the Congress controls the presidency, oversees the presidency, is through money, passing statutes. But of course, statutes are only so good as they're actually enforced. And we've seen this, or complied with, I should say. I mean, the impeachment process itself arose from essentially a whistleblower complaint that was not turned over to Congress pursuant to a statute. So we've seen this presidency ignore statutes. Statutes are only so good as they're enforced. And so a lot of this will come down, I think, to the 2020 election and people deciding whether sort of an erratic person at the helm of the military, who's increasingly isolationist in terms of his foreign policy. This issue was not raised with our allies. It affects many, many countries across the world. It could potentially put our troops in danger and put American people in danger, to the extent to which there are sleeper cells in the United States that are, were sort of sympathetic to this figure.
Now, going back and just looking, I'm thinking through in a non-systematic way the way that the president and Congress have worked out this tension. Rather famously, George H.W. Bush went to Congress to get authorization before the invasion of Iraq during the first Gulf War, right?
Right.
His son went to Congress to get this authorization for the use of military force, which apparently is still, at least the administrations have been claiming that it's still on the books. The Obama administration has cited it. The Trump administration has cited it. So you do have that authorization for the use of military force. These things were they required? Was the president required to get congressional approval? Or is this just part of the norms that we talk about so frequently?
Well, I mean, that would be back to the language. Answering that question would require us to go back to the language of the Constitution, which is the chicken and which is the egg, which has to happen first? Does there have to be an authorization of war? And I think that would be George Bush's attempt successfully to essentially check the box of the Constitution and weigh in favor of congressional war power. And that was, of course, a pre-authorization. As you indicate, it's been the gift that keeps on giving, kind of falling back to the idea, but we're getting further and further away from the basis for that pre-authorization, that is to use force in Iraq. But as you indicate, presidents have fallen back on that. But at the end of the day, you know, we've talked about this many times on this podcast, right? When people ask themselves the legitimate question, can the president do that? I mean, here's an easy framework, right? So we've got three branches of government, and then you ask yourself, okay, president does something. How is that? Where is the pushback on that? Here, it would be Congress. Congress has passed statutes, could withdraw this pre-authorization of war. If the president said, listen, I think my Article 2 power is more powerful than you, I'm going to do whatever I want anyway, then it could come down to filing a lawsuit in the courts, essentially saying Congress is enforcing its prerogative. Judge, please issue a decision and a mandate requiring the president to consult with us in advance. But as I indicated, the Supreme Court or federal courts could likely invoke what's called the political question doctrine, something that would also come up if there's a question on how the impeachment process is functioning, where federal courts essentially say, it's nowhere in the Constitution, but they essentially say, this is so political, we're out of this. We're not involving ourselves in this period. Go away, go back and handle it in the political process. So, you know, this is a dangerous time for democracy when the question really is, what are the checks meaningfully on the presidency and the office of the presidency, the power of the presidency? Because that mantle gets handed off to the next person, the next person, the next person. We're seeing now Donald Trump essentially seal the deal on the war powers.
So that's a perfect segue then to the fact that we're not only dealing with war powers, we're also dealing with a looming impeachment fight. Nancy Pelosi has so far held back the articles of impeachment, has not sent them forward to the Senate. I see some of the speculation is that she's going to do it this week at some point. She's going to send it over. Your take on that decision. On Nancy Pelosi basically saying, I'm going to hold off until I get some sort of an indication that this is not going to be a sham trial. They've had negotiations. There have been no breakthroughs, but it's probably likely that she's going to send it anyway. So is this worth doing?
You know, I have real problems with, as you know, the Democrats in the House impeachment process not pushing forward with the subpoenas and court sort of litigation to ensure full facts coming forward to the American public. And it does seem like now there's some, you know, second guessing of the kind of quick and dirty strategy of how they arrived at the articles of impeachment. I think there's plenty of evidence to justify those articles because we have so many admissions, frankly, from the president himself, but we're still seeing things leaking out through FOIA requests, for example, Freedom of Information Act requests, through the United States Congress.
The just security. I wanted to get to that. This just security scoop last week, which I'm concerned is getting lost in all the shuffle of the holidays and everything. But that was dramatic stuff. And it does raise exactly the question you just did. You know, we're having an impeachment proceeding, this investigation, and it was this private organization, would you describe them as a media organization or just an advocacy organization, comes up with this through a Freedom of Information Act request rather than through the investigatory process of Congress. And it's highly relevant, isn't it?
I mean, 100%.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, they asked for the documents that Congress could have asked for. I mean, just basically the communications relating to the OMB freeze on the $391 million of aid. I mean, it's as basic as can be in terms of what's relevant to the articles of impeachment. And the argument, I think, from the Democrats has been, well, the court system is too slow. Well, here we have a Freedom of Information Act request that went to Judge Kohler-Kutelli in the district court in a challenge because the government said, no, you can't have these documents. And she ordered them made public on a preliminary injunction. That means fast and dirty decision making. The court decides, listen, you're probably going to win on the merits. There's a harm to not getting this out in the public sector now, right now. So I'm going to order it made public. So that same type of process could have happened with subpoenas from the United States Congress. And arguably, they have an even stronger legal basis for obtaining this for purposes of impeachment. So back to your original question, you know, I think the Democrats now, they want to force the hand of the Senate to develop a factual record that they didn't develop in the House of Representatives. So I think one argument is, listen, it's too late. But I believe the better argument is the American public, whether it's, you know, better late than never, deserves full facts. They deserve to hear from these firsthand witnesses about what the decision president's thinking was when he actually withheld the aid and when he had the July 25th call. As far as this strategy, as I've written, I think, for the Bulwark, as if, you know, under the Senate rules that are as old as Andrew Johnson's impeachment trial, they're from the 19th century, the trial does require that she announce who the impeachment managers are going to be, the prosecutors essentially, and that mantle be turned over to the Senate once the Senate accepts those articles. The trial starts the next day. So as a practical matter, she wasn't going to do this over the holidays. I mean, the Senate could have held on it, but she does hold on to that power. So I don't know that this is so much strategy as just recognizing that she's a rule follower. And if once she hands them over, the way the rules go, it's 1 o'clock the next day and it goes for every day except for Sundays until the trial is concluded.
You made a really important point here. I'm going back to the just security revelations over the last week. I mean, they obviously strike a tremendous blow to the Republican defenses that there was no harm, no foul, no questions. It was a perfect call, all of that. It's really extraordinary in terms of the timeline. Also extraordinary in terms of what it tells us about the White House efforts to cover up what in fact was going on and their recognition that there were legal problems with that. So obviously it's a huge blow for the Republicans, but it also is embarrassing for the reasons that I think you mentioned to the Democrats, who are also saying that we can't wait to get this evidence. It would just take too long, when in fact they did. You know, all you needed to do was ask and push for it. So they should be a little bit red-faced about this, because you do wonder when you see something like this, what else is out there?
And
what was demonstrated is the power of the Freedom of Information Act and the willingness of the federal courts to do this. Now, rather more dramatically, the power of the Senate to compel testimony is considerable. So I'm going to get to that. So let's assume for the moment that we go for a full trial and presided over by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Is there any way that plausibly that Donald Trump could prevent the testimony of people like John Bolton or Mick Mulvaney if, in fact, that was the will of the Senate in a constitutionally, you know, authorized impeachment trial?
Well, I mean, I think that the argument, the other reason that the Democrats, I think, fell short in not pushing this is that the legal basis for defying a subpoena based on the notion that somehow I worked for the president, so I have complete immunity from showing up, is so paper thin that it's almost, in my view, sanctionable, frankly. And I know that's a strong word to say, but that our lawyers have to make decisions.
Yeah.
And how far you can push arguments. So there are actually ethical limitations that can have serious consequences for basically making frivolous arguments. And the notion that not only is there executive privilege, that is, here's a question, I'm not going to answer, what did you talk to Donald Trump about? That's calling for executive privilege. The witness goes to Congress. The question itself, almost like attorney-client, I won't answer that question. That's one thing. But to say you don't even have to show up, there's no basis for that. Presidents themselves don't have complete testimonial immunity. Both Clinton and Nixon litigated that all the way to the Supreme Court in different ways and lost that. So I think the answer, again, is, can Donald Trump stop witnesses from testifying? The issue is, what are the consequences? If those witnesses decide to defy a congressional subpoena to appear before the Senate, then the Senate would have to go to court for a motion to compel. If the court were to order that witness to comply, which I think they would under the law, and then the witness said, forget it, I'm still not complying, then that's really different. Because even though the Senate rules allow a contempt of the Senate, I don't know anything about a Senate jail, right? I mean, how does that actually enforce? But if a court order is violated, the U.S. Marshals, as we saw with the Whitewater investigation, with respect to a witness called Linda McDougal, the U.S. Marshals can actually put someone in jail and have them sit in jail until they decide to comply with the court order holding them accountable for complying with the congressional subpoena. So, you know, we talk about saber-rattling back to Iran and, you know, how important it is to show force. Likewise, it's really important in this moment constitutionally for the Congress to stand up for its prerogative as a co-equal branch of government. That's what is at stake in all of this. And as a constitutional scholar, I'm quite concerned, actually, that we're seeing our three-part branch of government, the separation of powers, slipping to the point where we'll have one mega branch, that is the presidency, and that really doesn't have meaningful checks. And then we're talking despotism. We're talking something quite ugly.
You know, you've made a really important point here, because we focused a lot on partisanship and the tribalization of American politics, which is obviously center to what's happening. But your point about the Congress's willingness to surrender its prerogatives, this has always been surprising to me. What's been surprising to me over the last several years, because you would think that you would have the normal jealousy for your own powers, the sense of, you know, Congress being a co-equal branch of government, you know, being unwilling. You would think they would be more unwilling to surrender those prerogatives, to make themselves as irrelevant as they sometimes feel. So you not only have this hyper-partisanship, but you do have the unwillingness of Congress to stand up and say, hey, we have, you know, a fundamental constitutional role to play here, too. We are not simply potted plants.
Right. And I think we saw this with the Nixon impeachment, where Republicans went to the president and said, listen, you're going to lose this. In this moment, there's no circumstances under which the Republicans would hold this president accountable for anything. At least it appears that way. When you have Mitch McConnell essentially saying we are going to work in lockstep with the White House in this impeachment process, that is certainly not an independent branch of oversight. And I know a lot of people who support President Trump like that. But what's good for the goose is good for the gander. And, you know, this presidency will go to another human being. And that might be someone we don't like, even if you like this particular president. And then it's too late to put the genie back in the bottle. That person will have the kinds of massive powers with unlimited oversight that Donald Trump has essentially been elbowing through with respect to this presidency. And that is of deep concern, because as we're seeing with, you know, Nancy Pelosi's feeble sort of attempt to kind of have a war power that actually is meaningful under the Constitution, once you hand it over, it's really hard to get that power back. It's really hard for Americans to have an accountable government once you've allowed government to get so big that there aren't any checks and balances on it. And that's really I think, bipartisan or nonpartisan concern. Yeah.
You would think, I mean, there was a time when conservatives worried about the excessive concentration of power in Washington or in the presidency. There was a time when this case you're making right now would have been fundamental. I find it ironic,
yeah,
because you ask conservatives why they support Donald Trump, and, you know, within the first 30 seconds, you're going to get, well, because of the courts, because of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Well, why is the court so important? Because we are supporters and defenders of the Constitution. Well, what does that mean? What is the Constitution?
Right.
And yet they turn around and will roll over for this incredible concentration of power in the hands of one man or one woman. And the you would think that simple prudence would lead them to understand the point you just made. You know, when it is President Elizabeth Warren, or
right,
when it is President AOC, how will they feel about the fact that they have ceded so much power, so much unchecked power, to the presidency? You know, in our federal and the normal balancing of powers.
Yeah, I mean, but we could just tick through things. The Emoluments Clause, right? Yeah. So that is one thing where the Constitution says it's up to Congress to essentially authorize emoluments. They've just been snoozing on that. So we now have a world where presidents can basically use the office for their own personal gain and to make a bunch of money. What about appropriations and the declaration of an emergency at the southern border by the president of the United States and diverting appropriated funds for something that Congress didn't authorize? That's another way Congress traditionally checks the office of the presidency and the executive branch, all these agencies that people get upset about. The idea is Congress gets to decide how that money is spent, but the president is end run around that. Impeachment clause. We've got an internal DOJ memo that says, and this isn't under Donald Trump, it's under Bill Clinton and Nixon before him, the DOJ, that says you can't, as a policy matter, our prosecutors aren't going to indict a sitting president. That takes the judicial branch out of checking a presidency for crimes, if we just assume there's a crime committed. But then we have the 1-2 punch of Bill Clinton, no removal because we had a crime, but no abuse of office. And what we'll probably see with Donald Trump is abuse of office, but not actually impeached for a crime. So neither of those work. That essentially, we might as well get our Sharpie out, cross the impeachment clause out of the Constitution. The war powers, declaration of war. I mean, you have to think about this. People, American soldiers will probably die as a result, or there's a high chance of a result of this escalation of conflict with Iran. That's the kind of thing that the American public should be able to weigh in on through their elected representatives in a debate in the United States Congress. That's the idea. That is not happening now. Unilateral use of force by the president. All of these things, I think people believe, Charlie, and having written this book and talked about it, that the Constitution is sort of like this guardian angel that hovers over America. And if there's a problem, the Constitution grows arms and legs and comes in to save us. But it's a piece of paper. If we don't enforce it, it's meaningless. And that's what we're seeing. Slowly, slowly crossing out ways of ensuring we don't slip into a monarchy and then just hope against hope that whoever's in that position is a good person and going to be ethically sound, right? That the framers knew that wasn't a good strategy.
Yeah, there was a period there where I think the smart take was, well, these concerns are overblown because, look, our institutions have proven themselves to be far more resilient than we might have thought. And your point is, no, we haven't really had that test yet. And I think that what we are being told, I mean, what we're realizing over and over again is how fragile this balance is and how much the constitutional order requires a functioning and responsible political world. And in the absence of that, our institutions are not going to be able to come out of this unscathed.
No way. I mean, another example is the appointment power. So the consent of the Senate to appoint members of the president's cabinet. We have Rudy Giuliani running around, private citizen, not even a contractor, not even legally bound by the terms of contract with the United States government, like Halliburton would be, for example, or Booz Allen, these big government contractors that do work for the United States. They're not bound by the Constitution, but they're bound by contract. So if they violate their contract, that can be enforced. Rudy Giuliani is basically a lone wolf that is conducting American foreign policy in a manner that's at odds with the institutional knowledge of years and decades of expertise within the United States government. So here's another part of the Constitution we can cross out. The consent part of the appointments power, if we can assume going forward, presidents can just pick whoever they want, not even bother going through that process, that is a check on the legitimacy of that choice. Is a check on the policy prerogatives that person is going to implement, is a check on their expertise, on their competence. And the American public gets to decide through their elected representatives in Congress whether they want that person for Secretary of State. We can chuck that out the window, too, because with the Giuliani situation, which the Senate is now going to authorize, the future presidents can just have their own gang in, that essentially is going to implement American foreign policy in ways that are best whoever's sitting in the White House.
Let me play devil's advocate then. From the Bill Barr philosophy of the unitary executive or the Bill Barr / Trumpian view that the president can do whatever he wants in terms of this. So why can't he use, his friends, members of his family as intermediaries on foreign policy? There's nothing really that prevents him from doing that. Other presidents have used informal back channels. Why is this different?
It's different because the channels are being used in a way that's not consistent with American foreign policy and what's best in the interest of the United States. If you say the interest of the United States, and I think the documents, as you mentioned, are coming out that affirm what the witnesses said in the impeachment trial the impeachment process that produced the articles, that it's in America's interest to keep Ukraine democratic. It's in America's interest to support Ukraine in its longstanding civil war against Russia, for Russia to basically, as we saw in 2013 with invading a part of Ukraine called Crimea, to basically take over Ukraine again. I mean, Ukraine is at the frontier between Western democracy and Eastern sort of Putin-esque axis of evil under our last Republican president, right? George Bush called the Russians one of those three axes of evil. And this is not something Republicans have generally embraced, is the Putin regime. But we have Rudy Giuliani sort of not necessarily acting to implement that objective. I mean, the withholding of the aid was bad for America. So that's different from, say, Franklin Delano Roosevelt using private emissaries in a way to ensure America's interests kind of behind channels. I mean, again, Charlie, as you indicate, what's scary, I think, to a lot of people who don't have a lot of expertise in the Constitution is how vague it is. How much play there is in the joints. It isn't sort of a 65 miles per hour speeding limit. But even that, if you don't get tickets for driving 80 miles an hour, people will go 80 miles an hour. So there's two pieces. One is, how clear is the Constitution? And it's vague on a lot of this stuff. This is why I get upset when people kind of claim originalism as an answer. Even conservative judges have to interpret a vague language. It's just the nature of reading an old document. So that is really, I think, something that we have the question of the vagueness of the language. And then the two is, who's the cop on the block issuing the tickets for speeding in the presidency? And the Congress isn't doing it. And even if the House does something, the Democrats now, Mitch McConnell, as you know, I wrote this piece in the Bulwark a few months ago, has sort of functioned to anoint himself, you know, chancellor of the Congress. So even if there's bipartisan support for a bill in the House of Representatives that's theoretically supported by the people, the constituents, he can say, I'm not going to even bring it to the Senate. That there's no power for him to do that in the Constitution. You could make the argument that he has a prerogative, it's an obligation to make sure that that bill, which has bipartisan support, makes its way through the entire process. We're seeing the same thing with Nancy Pelosi. There's nothing in the Constitution that forces her hand here. It comes down to political will. And then this gets to this question of norms and ethics and values. We do want people in office that kind of have a conscience, that want to do the right thing.
One last question on all of this. I should have gotten to this a little bit earlier, because the president over the weekend is also threatening to attack these cultural sites in Iran, which would be in violation of international law, might be considered to be war crimes. And in fact, this is a president that really campaigned on making war crimes great again. I mean, you know, he's talked about the fact that, you know, we will kill the family members of terrorists. We will, you used to tell the story, the fake story about the Black Jack Pershing using bullets soaked in pig blood to kill Muslims, right, and all of those sorts of things. So, if the president of the United States, what is the legal standard? The commander in chief orders members of his military to attack a mosque, something that they would recognize to be a war crime. Does the president, as the commander in chief, have the power to order members of the U.S. military to carry out that kind of an attack?
Well, I mean, I haven't studied that particular legal question, but sort of from a meta scale, when it comes to the Constitution, this isn't answered either in terms of, okay, a unitary executive theorist like Bill Barr might say, the president is the boss and the president has taken this position, even if the president orders people within the rank and file to violate a law. If we accept that this would be a war crime, you could make the argument the president is a commander in chief and has to make hard decisions, including authorizing force that kills people, puts people, American citizens, in harm's way. That can encompass things that would be considered a war crime. We saw this under George Bush, Bush second, with respect to waterboarding and the concept of what's the definition of torture, right? That some scholars thought defining torture, as the Bush administration did, as something short of organ failure was really pushing it too far. I would argue, and we hear this a lot all the time, that there is something broader that governs our constitutional structure. And we hear this as called the rule of law. The idea that it's the Constitution, it's the statutes that are passed pursuant to a democratically elected Senate and Congress and House of Representatives that really governs everyone's behavior. Nobody is above the law. So in that moment, a military officer could say, I'm not going to execute that order because it's illegal. We saw this with the Saturday Night Massacre, where Nixon tried to fire the special prosecutor that was investigating him. And you saw people within sort of his chain of command say, no, I won't do that. But again, it gets back, Charlie, to my other point. I think we want heroes in government. We want people that are going to take risks, whistleblower, for example, put themselves at risk to do the right thing, to act with integrity. And we seem to be in a moment where integrity, values, compassion in leadership is just considered optional. And well, I just don't agree with that.
And the other point that you've made several times is who's the cop on the block who's going to enforce it? The President of the United States orders war crimes. They are adjudicated to be war crimes by some international tribunal. The President could turn around and pardon anyone that carried out his orders or that committed the war crimes. He's already indicated a willingness to do that with the Navy SEALs. And then the question becomes, who's going to do something about it? So again, this goes back to the point you're making about that you want people of good character. Kim, thank you so much for all the time.
Oh, always so great.
This is so great. The book is, and it is absolutely essential reading in 2020, How to Read the Constitution and Why, Kim Whaley, who's a professor of law, legal expert, contributor to The Bulwark, contributor to CBS News. Thanks for joining me on a busy Monday.
Thank you, Charlie. It was great.
And thank you for listening to The Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.